Well, we certainly appreciate the selection of the topic of Nehemiah by the brethren here in Columbus. And I have to say, it was a little bit of a white spot on my mental map, even though historically I was somewhat okay with when the events and the Nehemiah and the book of Nehemiah happened. It really didn't kind of gel together. So I really appreciated this opportunity to organize my knowledge a little bit about the account. And our topic is the historical account. We use the verse from Nehemiah 2:17, where the report that he gives, or the state of the situation that he gives to his brethren. Jerusalem is a pile of ruins, and its gates have been burnt with fire. Come, let's rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, then we will not be ashamed anymore. And I think that it's this sense of rebuilding, of preventing the shame, preventing the exposure to enemies, that motivated Nehemiah to proceed with this project. And when we say the word Nehemiah, it's a little bit of a slight change from the original. And it's kind of funny how this works. You know, Nehemiah, the H in it. Thank you. Okay, it's going to be displaying now. Nehemiah has this H in it, and that H is silent in our language. Ah, there it is. Yet it's not silent in the Hebrew language. In Hebrew, in fact, it's that K sound. So when you say Nehemiah in Hebrew, you would say Nehemiah, and that H is not silent. It's like in the word lechaim, you know, which we all know, to life, or the other word in which that H is kind of silent in English, but it's very well pronounced in Hebrew, is Bethlehem. So in Bethlehem, we don't really say that H, and lechem is really the word for bread. So Bethlehem is the house of bread. So when we think about Nehemiah, let's think about the other possibility, Nehemiah. And that's how some other languages render it. But what we want to look at is the historical timeline of all the events that lead to Nehemiah's situation that we find in the book of Nehemiah. We want to look at his position, in other words, the role that he played both in the Persian Empire as well as in Jerusalem. The project that he undertook, the enemies and challenges, and the outcomes, and the test. And there's going to be a test. No, there won't be. It will be just a description of what the test was for Nehemiah and the outcome of his work. So we start our historical timeline. This may take us just a few minutes. We'll be going back to this chart with hopefully somewhat of a cohesive sequence of events and some years that we will put in there. Chronology is not my subject of expertise. However, I do feel quite comfortable that the historical accounts that we have right around from the days of the Nehemiah, or from the days of Cyrus, as we will see, are pretty well documented. So I'm a little more relaxed that perhaps we'll be closer to the truth versus possibly from other periods. But when we start this historical timeline, we want to get set here in the two frames, as though, for the really crucial turning point events. One is, and both of them are really well expressed in Psalms. One is in Psalm 137:1, by the rivers of Babylon. There we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. And then Psalm 126, when the Lord brought us back to Jerusalem, it was like a dream, how we laughed, how we sang for joy. And of course, those are the events that surround the Babylonian captivity at first, and the release from that captivity by the edict of Cyrus. So here's our timeline, and as we go through these events, if you cannot see it, we'll try to zoom in like so, and maybe we'll be able to go left and right. But if you still cannot see, please come closer, and it may actually help as well. But, you know, when I was growing up in Poland, and maybe that was not something that the brethren here had in the United States in the 70s. There was a European group, Boney M. I'm not sure if you are connecting that, but for those of us who are in Europe, they may know it. And they sang this song, "By the Rivers of Babylon, There We Sat Down." And, you know, to us Polish people, we really enjoyed this word, Babylon. It was like this kind of phrase. But we didn't realize that it was actually a quotation from the Psalm. And little did we know that once we kind of learned a little more, and I learned English and somehow studied these lessons, that tune really helps me appreciate the sentiments that the Jewish people had when they were taken to Babylon by the sequential waves of captivity. And it started a little earlier, but in its final timing, when Nebuchadnezzar took Jerusalem, burned his general Nabuzaradan, as we have it described in 2 Kings 25:8, burned the gates. Gates were made of wood, destroyed the walls. The temple was destroyed. And that was the time when this terrible, crucial turning point really hit the hardest. And it hit the most of the Jewish people. They were taken to captivity. And then in Lamentations, Jeremiah writes, "The Lord has scorned his altar, disowned his sanctuary. He has delivered into the hand of the enemy the walls of her palaces." And here again, we remember the Psalm 137, because in the Psalm it says, "Those who are the oppressors have asked us to sing the songs of Zion." And how can we sing the songs of Zion? How difficult it is. So those were the sentiments of the Hebrew people that have gone both from Judah and from the broader Israel by the time that the final captivity occurred to the destinations in Babylon. They were far away. They were probably over 1,000 miles far. There were some cities, some locations that the Jewish people established there, and it was definitely initially a very traumatic experience, loss of life, and loss of that connection to the land. But those who were paying attention, they probably would have remembered some words from Jeremiah. In Jeremiah 29:7, he anticipates this situation. And he tells them to be of good cheer, that things will turn out for better. And even he says this in 29:7, "Seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. For thus says the Lord of hosts, God of Israel, do not let your prophets and your diviners who are among you deceive you, and do not listen to the dreams that they dream. For it is a lie that they are prophesying to you in my name. I did not send them, declares the Lord. For thus says the Lord, when 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will visit you, and I will fulfill to you my promise and bring you back to this place." And now this verse that we often quote in some personal greetings, and now it's good to remember where it's coming from. "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope." And, you know, sometimes when we go through difficult experiences in our lives, we will have this reminder of the scripture. We also want to be reminded that it took a little time for this nation and for individuals in it to realize that these plans were for good and to wait for that deliverance. As we know, this deliverance did come because when the 70 years for Babylon were fulfilled, something happened, and that something was actually prophesied to the very, very exact name by a prophet Isaiah. And that name that Isaiah gave was the name Koresh. And the citation would be from Isaiah 40:45, and I think we will come to it on another slide. But this word Koresh is really the name for Cyrus in the Persian language. And so he did prophesy 150 years earlier that Cyrus will be the shepherd, that he will be the anointed one that will reestablish the land and will reopen the opportunity to be to build the temple. So as we go through this understanding and the view of the situation in Babylon, we appreciate that this was a very hard experience for those who were now no longer in their land, and it was a test of their of what really they stood for, what kind of priorities they had in their life. Was it the Lord that they really appreciated and cherished? This would be the time to really test that determination and that faithfulness and to realize why they were finding themselves there. So a change of empires came right around the year 539 to 538, when the king Nebuchadnezzar's descendants, and more specifically it was Belshazzar, who was the, as they call, the historians call him, an issue from Nabonidus, who was a king in the later part of Babylon, was in the castle or in the city, surrounded by walls, the city of Babylon, when suddenly that hand appeared on the wall that says, "You've been found wanting." And we know what effect this had on the king Belshazzar, and only the prophet Daniel could really explain the meaning of that. That really the events that were happening were imminent, that that very night, this king would have to surrender to the forces of the king Cyrus. And even though in the book of Daniel it says, "And Darius the Mede took his place," what we understand is that Darius the Mede really was the same timing as Cyrus, which is the deliverer, of which we will see the slide right here. But what this Darius the Mede was really a governor for Cyrus himself, and he took the place, in Babylon. So when we study the history and historical account of the various kings of Persia, we want to realize that their names are somewhat confusing, and oftentimes it seems that the name Darius occurs two or three or four times throughout the history. Or the Xerxes or Artaxerxes, they are oftentimes names that are repeated for different individuals. And I think having that in mind will help us perhaps bring together the logic or the consistency of these accounts. But what we do see is that Cyrus the Great was in power from 539 to 530 BC or BCE. That after him there were two minor kings, but they were already relevant and they are described in the history of Ezra. And then there was the king Darius, which we will talk about in a little bit. You know, Cyrus the Great, he is called Cyrus the Great for a great reason. He combined two kingdoms, the Medes and the Persians. He actually, as I understand it, took the kingdom away from his grandfather, with whom he was associated via marriage to a woman from that family. And now he was able to combine the power of the two empires. And Babylon was already on its last legs at the time. So when we look at this map here from Babylon, and you look at these the map here that will show you the coverage of the Babylonian rule, the Medo-Persian rule was definitely much more and much wider because of the fact that already these two kingdoms were previously connected. But what do we read about the edict of Cyrus? We read about it in Ezra 1 and 2 and also 2 Chronicles. And it says, "Thus saith Cyrus, the king of Persia, the Lord of heaven, God hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. And so, why did he say that? Well, we know that he was a very tolerant king. In fact, as opposed to the Babylonians who were taking the nations captive and bringing them to their land and mixing things up in the lands that they conquered, he actually released those prisoners and he brought them back to those locations that they came for. But specifically, and we don't know exactly if this is what he meant here, the word the Lord is the word Jehovah, right? And he does refer to it in this way in the quotation here in Ezra 1:2. And we read again, this is the quote we were looking for in Isaiah 44:24, 150 years before this event. Thus saith the Lord thy Redeemer, and he that formed thee from the womb, that saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, he shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. So when this edict was announced, Ezra, the book of Ezra, which comes before Nehemiah, says, then rose up the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests, and the Levites, with all them whose spirit of God raised, to go up and to build the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. So, let's think about this. So, if the nation of Israel was in Babylon for about, depending on your chronological time frame, at least 50 years, and the 70 years have come down and been fulfilled for Babylon, we will observe that there was a lot of time and generation switch too during that time. And yet there was the result in some of them, and in probably not as many as went in to stand up, to get up and to build the house of Jerusalem. But one observation that we want to make here is that even though this edict was made, and you know, we would almost think, if we kind of have like a little bit of a black and white historical thinking, oh, the Jews were released, they were able to go back to Jerusalem. Oh, that's wonderful. Everyone went and the story has a happy ending. Well, not exactly, because things probably aren't exactly that black and white. Especially, you know, 50 years go over and people who moved to Babylon have become comfortable in their surroundings and their work. They actually were quite prosperous. As we said, Jeremiah encouraged them to make the land that they go to prosperous. And maybe a little too prosperous for themselves and perhaps a little too neglectful or negligent of the truths and the law and all the different things that they took away from their homeland, so that in the end it was really up to those who had that desire and resolve to get up and go. And only 9 short years later, Cyrus was dead. Things were kind of up to those who really wanted to pursue this edict, this law. What we find about the Persian law is that it was irrevocable. So that's really good. It kind of worked both ways, good and bad, as you probably know. But in this case, this was something they could hang on to. They could go back to some records in the future. They would go back to the records in the past and say, ha, see what happened back there? This was our promise. This was our commitment. And what Cyrus really did do for the Jewish people is he said, take you some funds, let the treasury give you funds, all the vessels that the Jews cherished, because they were taken by force by Nebuchadnezzar, was amazingly energized. We know of the names of Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel, okay? Now, some think that perhaps this was one person. Some others would suggest that they were two separate people. They were both in leading roles during that time, and that's still during Cyrus's life, so that's around 536, that they make this effort, and between 42,000 and 49,000 return. The articles of the temple return, and the work on building the altar, rebuilding the altar first, and the temple is started. And it's very interesting. This is a question I have that I don't have the answer for, and look forward to definitely our discussions here. How many Jews really went to Babylon? And when they went first, you know, at the beginning of the captivity, on the specific waves. I would be interested in hearing, and perhaps there is even a verse that I missed, that actually specifies that. But I think it was a vast, vast number, much greater than the 50,000 here that we are thinking about. But think about the number 50,000. Think about a village or a town, like the town of Naperville has, I think, 104,000 by now residents. But we know that it's not a very large number. This is a nation that was probably going into millions, and we see 50,000 returning. Zerubbabel, Sheshbazzar, they are the leaders. They really are thrilled to lead this nation. They cherish. They were waiting for that hope. They, as in the beginning of the book of Nehemiah, the book of Ezra, excuse me, is the phrase that, just like Jeremiah said, those years were fulfilled. We understood it, as Daniel says, and that was the momentum to move them. Now, we see these, as we go back to our timeline, we see that during this time of Cyrus and then these other kings and the rebuilding of the altar and the temple, that there were some people that weren't exactly thrilled with the return of the Jews back to their land. Now, those people would probably be those who just didn't care for Jews overall. They would be the nations that were brought in there by Nebuchadnezzar in the place of the people who originally lived there. Maybe they were their neighbors, you know, those that would be like the Ammonites on the east and others that would just not be, you know, very thrilled. So what did they do? Well, they all had these representatives between their regions and the king, the Persian king, and they would send letters kind of reporting the Jews and basically reminding the king that really, you know, you're dealing with a nation that's quite quite rebellious. And so therefore, be careful with them. And in fact, when they are about to rebuild their temple or maybe set up some walls, you know what that means. That means that they'll reestablish their identity and suddenly they will rebel. And yes, indeed, when these kings like Cambyses or Smerdes, these ones right after Cyrus, when they looked into the books, I think they did find that indeed kings like Zedekiah or the one before him did actually, even though they were puppet kings, eventually they decided to rebel against the prior king Nebuchadnezzar, and so then this accusation was confirmed. So the king who is, I think, referred to as Artaxerxes, but it's, in my opinion, not the same Artaxerxes that we will deal with later in the days of Nehemiah, says, stop, we're not building anything, you're right, this is a nation that's suspect, we want to definitely hold off on everything. So the enemies of Israel were for a moment gratified and thought that it wouldn't go anywhere. But the scriptural account in Ezra tells us that that didn't last too long, that the prophet Haggai reminded the people that they're there for a reason, that they should not be afraid and they should again try to start the effort. So what did they do? They went back to the king with another letter and say, greetings, O king, beyond the river. And it's kind of funny how they say, King James translation says, greetings and all, or something like that. It kind of sounds a little funny for our reading, but it basically means we greet you with, you know, the standard greeting. And you know what? Check around, because just a few years ago, this King Cyrus, with whom this whole Medo-Persian Empire has started, that king Xerxes, who at night couldn't sleep and was kind of saying, hey, can you tell me what happened in the history of our nation? They were reading those accounts to them. I think those records, those accounts are very important and cherished and, again, irreversible. So, yes, King Darius, I believe, discovered that indeed this really was what Cyrus had said not too long ago, maybe 10 years ago or 15, and therefore, yes, the rebuilding should continue. This is the right thing to do. And so because of these consistencies of the Persian rule of law, the project could continue. And the temple, was finished in the year 516 or 515 by some accounts, BC. So we're going back, reducing the years. And actually during this time, as we kind of zoom out a little bit, we don't really have a lot of, information about what the spirits were in the land of Israel, how the 50,000 that were, growing their gender, progressing, they were getting older, new babies were being born, how this culture and how this, mentality was continuing, and where their spirit was. Were they as enthused? Were they disappointed? In the beginning of the inauguration of the temple, there is a kind of bittersweet moment when they are dedicating the temple, and there is a noise of laughter and there is a noise of crying at the same time, and you can't really tell whether they're laughing or crying or being rejoiceful or sad, and yet it was both. Remember the glory of the temple of Solomon, and maybe they also were moved by the fact that the Lord has brought them back. Maybe they remembered the sins and the repentance that this nation should really now demonstrate. And maybe they didn't see it yet come in. And so they cried. The old ones cried. The young ones were rejoicing. This is our effort. We are building it up. It's something that will help us to go forward. So very moving description from the otherwise sometimes dry historical account. But then we go to this time after Darius the First. We go to the time of Xerxes or King Ahasuerus by other accounts. And that's when the story of Esther and Mordecai takes place. We think that the historical records here are quite consistent, 485 to 464 BC. Esther and Mordecai are in a situation where Esther is now a queen, because she has been selected for her beauty and undoubtedly wonderful character by the king Xerxes. And there's a situation. There's someone who doesn't exactly like the Jews, Haman, to whom Mordecai did not bow one day. And he says, well, we have to do away with Mordecai. And someone says, but wait a second, he's a Jew. Oh, then why don't we just do away with all the Jews? And so that was the case. He kind of did not really have a good idea when this could happen. So he says, let's just cast some lots. And there was a lot that was cast for someday in March. In fact, in the Jewish calendar, let's see here, that was the month of Adar. And it was still some months away, but it was already decided that in the month of Adar, which I think we can see right in the upper right corner here on this Jewish calendar, when all the Jews will be totally exterminated, and since Haman had kind of an in with the king at that time, the king says, you know what, do exactly what you need to do. This will be coming back soon. He says, do what you need to do. I trust you. I think this is a good thing. So we'll just go ahead for it. Well, as we know, Esther invited both Haman and the king to a special banquet, not once, but a couple of times, and, begged him to spare the life of her nation. And the king was very surprised. What do you mean? Well, I am Jewish, and, this is what you're about to do. So he got pretty mad, and in fact, Haman at that time was trying to beg Esther for just one last bit of mercy. And when the king came back to that room, he thought that he was even trying to attack Esther, and so he got really upset at Haman. Haman got the treatment that he was hoping Mordecai, Esther's uncle or cousin, would get. And so what we are ending up with is this temporary, light of favor. And yet, that date, as we remind ourselves, for that month of Adar, just a few months away, was still set. The Persian law is irrevocable. What do we do? Well, the king gave it to Esther to kind of decide with Mordecai what they want to do. And they suggested that there's going to be another law. That, yes, that first law is good, not good, but we have to accept it. Now, the second law would now allow the Jews to fight and defend themselves. And so really, that's what happened. On that month, and during on that day of the month of Adar, if we remember, there's about 75,000 people who were killed by the Jews in self-defense because they had that hatred against the Jewish nation. But Haman's law also had the Jews not only be killed, but also their properties being taken away. And here is, I think, a hint that we see that the Jewish people were quite prosperous wherever they lived in all the provinces of the Persian domain, and so therefore they did not they were not only hated just for the fact of being Jewish, but perhaps they were hated for envy and other things. And so many people rose against the Jews during that time, and thankfully the Jews were able to organize themselves and defend themselves by this miraculous turn of events, in which, as we see, Mordecai gained this trusted position. And when we think about this trusted position, that's when we, I think, come close to the role that Nehemiah played to the next king, right after Xerxes, Artaxerxes. And that's what we will be talking about in a little bit. Now, we go back to our timeline. If this works as expected, we are seeing that, by the way, these masks that you see, they are the commemoration of that feast of Purim. And Purim in Persian language means loss. It's that date that was assigned for the extermination, total extermination of the Jews that was avoided. And so this is commemorated to this day right around the month of Adar, which is around March. But as time goes on, we see that the Jewish people have, some confidence and trust with the monarch, with Xerxes, and then with his successor Artaxerxes. And so that's what we, I think, see in the beginning of Artaxerxes' reign. Well, in the 13th year, Ezra. This is now where the actual book of Ezra begins. Not the recounting of the first return, which was in 536, but now Ezra's timing in around 458 BC, which is the 13th year of Artaxerxes. And at that time, with Ezra, who was a scribe, who was a teacher of the law, about 5,000 more returned. So we are now between those who already returned and those who, were born, and those who returned with this in this next wave. We are, probably well above 50,000 residents in the nation, in the land of Israel, right around Judah, and Jerusalem. And this is how we then come to the story of Nehemiah, which we are going to look at next. So Nehemiah's position was that he was with the king, with King Artaxerxes, and he was close to him. He was the cupbearer, a trusted and responsible position. You know, in modern day and age, we have all kinds of, locks and securities, and I'm sure back then, when the king's life was in danger, it was really easy to find and catch someone who would come with some sort of a weapon and try to approach the king. But one way that the king's life could be in danger would be by sending him gift of a, bottle of wine or some container of some wonderful food, and perhaps then the king would enjoy it, but that might be his last meal if that thing was sent by his. So the cupbearer was someone who, I guess in the strictest sense would have tasted some of the food that the king was about to have. Maybe in a larger sense, he was possibly in charge of the supply chain of the whole food delivery system. Maybe he even saw how the plants were grown, how the grapes of wine were processed, and he made sure that there was good supervision of that. We don't know exactly how deep that responsibility lied, but we know about Nehemiah that he was in Nehemiah's career in the 20th year of the same king Artaxerxes. some brethren, and Nehemiah was a Jew, as we know, to him from the land of Israel and say, look, things are not looking great. We are constantly being derided. Our city is in ruin. Not much really has changed. You know, that brochure that we saw from the days of Cyrus, well, it's a little different now. We need to do something more. And that really troubled Nehemiah. The first thing we hear about him that he said was that he really prayed and fasted. And that whole time took about 4 months when he considered the report from his brethren from Jerusalem and went in prayer, fasted, and asked for favor. As we read in this prior screen, give your servant mercy in the eyes of that man. So even though Nehemiah's position was so important, yet he felt that there is nothing more important, no one more important than God, and therefore favor with this man would be something grand. And indeed, one day when Nehemiah was serving the meal or having the meal with the king, his face was really sad. And you know, when someone who is serving you food and who you depend on for safety and your life is sad, then you're kind of a little concerned about that. So was the king. It's like, you know, your technology person looks at the computer, your computer, and says, oh, this isn't good. You know, you're kind of worried then. You know that, okay, something isn't right. Well, I think that's why the king says, Nehemiah, something is wrong. What's going on? And that's when Nehemiah poured his heart out to the king and said, well, we have a problem back in our land. Excuse me. I don't know that he cried, but he was close to it. No, I'm sure that he was on his knees in prayer and many times cried and fasted. But in the scene with the king, he did definitely say there is a problem. And maybe he was able to present it in such a way that he would say, you know what, this is an exposure to the stability of the region. You know, even though in Judah there may be a governor who is now currently, you know, in charge, but this doesn't really look good. This does not really even reflect well on your kingdom. Perhaps those were some arguments that Nehemiah, as we see his mind, and as we look later, his mind was, one of an organizer, one of a leader, someone who has a vision and kind of knows how things work. And so therefore maybe he was able to convince the king. So there was a good reason why he was in that position with the king. The king says, so how long are you going to be gone? Nehemiah let him 12 years for that first mission to go to Jerusalem, accomplish that project that he wanted to do, and then stay and monitor how things worked. But at that time, we don't really know if he already knew, give me about 12 years and I'll be back. Because today, if your employee said that, you know, I just need to take a leave and I'll be back with you in 12 years, probably that wouldn't work very well. But what Nehemiah did want to do is he wanted to say, you know, I can help you. I can help represent your government to the people there. I know the culture. He probably knew the language. Definitely the language spoken was not only Hebrew, but Aramaic. The king says, you know what? If you're going, this is just my theory, why don't you just become the governor there? You know, we will just have you. I trust you. I know you'll do a good job. I see this is important to you. Why don't you go and be the governor? So he was appointed governor for that, area of Judah. Before we go there, let's just look at those wonderful, cups that the Persian kings were drinking from. And, we have kind of gone a little simpler these days. But they really, probably, I mean, looking at this, these horns of, made of silver and, gold, and those would be the cups that probably Nehemiah was able to serve to the king. They probably kind of simulate both, the power of the Persian Empire, Persian animals that represent strength, the horns, you know, probably this is a lion's head on that cup, that golden cup. And, we also see this kind of possibly a simulation of a horn, of an animal's horn from which you would drink, like, oftentimes it was this horn of abundance that we often see in And certain, you know, pictures possibly even associated with the harvest time. But then we have this relief of someone who is called a satrap or satrap, who is a provincial official who is receiving a visitor. This is from that time, and that's what the region of Judah. So as we look at the book of Nehemiah, I found this really nice outline by Professor Christopher Abraham that kind of shows the division of the chapters. There's 13 chapters in the book of Nehemiah, and he described it as the first part is Nehemiah talks to God, which we have already mentioned. Then Nehemiah talks to the king. That's really what has happened. Then the work is planned. Then the work is complete. Then there is a recounting of the number of people involved living and dwelling in Jerusalem and who and where they might live. There is a covenant that was renewed and some further reforms, and as we have discussed the results. So we jump right into the project that Jeremiah undertook. Jeremiah would be Nehemiah in this case, and he was meeting with the local people when he arrived in Jerusalem. He didn't really tell them what he was going to do directly, at least not to everybody. He perhaps had a crowd of or a group of trusted folks, and so he convinced them. He told them that the hand of God, which was upon which it was good upon him, and also the king's words that he had spoken unto him, and they said, let's rise up and build. Now, Nehemiah received, in addition to just the appointment of being the governor, he also received some support. He got some funds, he got some military aid, and a commitment that there would be building materials coming for the project. Because even though there was probably an abundance of stones in Jerusalem and the areas, you did need some solid wood for the gates, and we will be looking at those gates in a little bit. But here is a few depictions of Nehemiah's inspection of Jerusalem. He was walking actually at night, probably to be not too distinguished. Probably they knew that he was the newcomer from the city of Susa, which is where he had been with the Persian king, and so he did not want to make big show of it, but he did want to get an idea of what's happening. And there was a point at which he actually could no longer use his horse, and he had to walk on foot. There are some places named there that actually do tell us what the scope of the project would be, of which we'll just... Generally, the city was in ruins. He could not even get through certain, piles of rubble, and therefore he was quite disheartened on one sense. And yet, in his mind of a leader, you would see this understanding. Aha! This is what we need to do. He names the gates, that he walked by the Valley Gate, the Dragon Well, the Dung Gate, and he inspected the places where the walls of Yerushalayim or Jerusalem were broken down, and where its gates had been burnt down. And there was no room for the animal under me to pass, he says. He went up in the valley in the dark and went on inspecting the wall. So hopefully the night was bright at that time, and the skies were clear, so he could see enough of the detail to run. When we look at the project that he had to do, we kind of wonder what exactly could he accomplish. And having both the skilled and enough workers, as well as, know exactly what to do. So the description from Nehemiah really helps us pin down at least the approximate focus of this work. Now, the city of Jerusalem has kind of gone through different times of expansion. In the last day, one of the later kings, Hezekiah's, he actually built out some more walls around the original city. So let's just look at this area here. This right here, see if we can put the laser pointer, but it can't work with the zoom. Okay, so right here we would see, this would be the city of David, which is the probably the original Jerusalem that David conquered from the Jebusites, and that would have been the original city. Over here, toward the, I believe this would be toward the north, would be the temple and the area where the temple was rebuilt at the time when Nehemiah was visiting it. But it looks like, just simply mentioned too that over here on these kind of outer areas to the west, there would be this other wall that Hezekiah had built up. And we'll have a better picture of that in a second. But it does look like this kind of oblong shape of Jerusalem is what appears to be in scope for work for Nehemiah and these different gates that he names in chapter 3 when he appoints the teams to actually do the work, really confirm that. But there is still some discrepancies and some discussions among the archaeologists. Here is another shot of this core city of Jerusalem. Perhaps some of you who are very familiar with it, you might even have an answer to this, but it looks like this is that original area where the temple and the city of David would be right here. And then to the left of it, from our point of view, are the villages and that wall that Nehemiah would have built up previously. Now, during the siege that lasted 18 months, and after the siege, when Nebuchadnezzar actually overcame Jerusalem, these walls were all destroyed, and likely this would have been a very large effort for Nehemiah to accomplish, to rebuild all these walls around the villages. And likely, too, there were not too many residents in these villages. So what we think is that his focus indeed was just these core walls here, and the descriptions of the gates seem to confirm that. So we will just kind of overlay the map that we saw before of this kind of oblong shape with all these boundaries and understand that this is what Nehemiah was trying to do. But there are some theories. Here is a wonderful presentation on YouTube by Dan Lewis, who is a retired professor from Tyndale College in Michigan. But he is describing these two theories of the maximalists and the minimalists in this study. And some people do that core city. Then, in other words, it would really go into the walls of that Hezekiah had expanded. So we will not be arguing this point. However, what we will say is that the sections for this work were assigned meticulously. You kind of see a great project manager who is trying to make sure that things get done and that they get done by the deadline. And of course, the deadline is something we want to talk about in a second. But you know how the tunnel of Hezekiah, in which he connected the stream with the pool inside that city, inside of that enclosure. Maybe we can go back and just kind of show this right here. So Hezekiah's tunnel is from somewhere here all the way to down here where there is the pool of Siloam. And what he did is, in order to prevent the water from coming off this cliff from the Gihon or Gihon brook or spring, the water was previously going out and kind of watering these gardens, but when those who were besieging Jerusalem were coming close, he says, why should they find much water? Let's try and see if we can contain this water. So he built this tunnel inside of Jerusalem right here. And the way that they built it is they kind of were coming from two directions, and they met in the middle. And if you ever go to Jerusalem, you will see this nice tour of going through Hezekiah's tunnel that they built. But they met, perhaps Nehemiah, mindful of that, he says, you know what, why don't we assign sections? And yes, people will be meeting at the junction points of all these sections. So you will see all the names of people, of priests, of some people that were well-to-do, who didn't even come there, they just kind of threw some money at it and sent their servants. And Nehemiah is very direct. He is kind of quite direct of saying, yeah, these people didn't even move their hand. Yes, they did send their servants, but they themselves didn't participate. But we see that the priests would have built the walls right here by the temple, and others would be corresponding. So we will just look at just some names that are very specifically describing the different sections, and this is quite a nice document for us. And here we have a little rendition of people who are already building, and they're actually also unfortunately needing to have some weapons on them because there is a danger from the local people. So now we look at those dangers and those challenges. The enemies are mentioned in the book of Nehemiah. They are Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the servant, and Ammonite, and the Arabian, or Geshem. So they were not too happy about this whole development. And, you know, when you look at the kind of dynamic of that situation where Nehemiah is resolved to build and to repopulate this local part, kind of from the other nations are unhappy about it, you know where this is finding a very good replica in today's situation in the land of Israel. And so I think when these situations do arise, those who are in them do have to remember the history to really how those who had the resolve were really helped by the Lord. But they all, each of these, have a certain amount of hostility, and they use different methods against the workers who are building the wall. They sneer. They give even threats of physical attacks, and they provide extreme discouragement, such as, for example, you know what? Yeah, go ahead and build, and when a fox jumps on this wall, I'm sure that wall will collapse. Or things that basically would have Nehemiah go to some location. We want to meet with you, and we want to kind of have a little meeting. And after maybe three requests, Nehemiah realizes this is probably just an attempt to assassinate me, and so therefore I'm not going anywhere. But Nehemiah, in his strength and leadership, gave certain orders and appointed people to be standing by with their swords. And so he says, unfortunately, half of the people had to be equipped with weapons and watching out for any sort of danger, while others were building. And he said, don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. So those external challenges were met with Nehemiah's very resilient faith and courage. And we think that's an example, and I'm sure we'll be talking about this in the further lesson, internal challenges. Nehemiah found that this society of the Jewish people returning was again, both polarized, and it had certain, layers of well-to-do and those who were working hard. And he actually was approached by the poor who were complaining that they were being taken advantage of. They had some loans with their richer brethren. They were in bondage for things that they couldn't pay. They had to pay interest or usury. And so Nehemiah influenced that actually when he met with those influential, richer providers, they actually said, okay, we won't be doing that. Now, that was possibly a combination of him being a well-educated Jew in the rules of the law that said no usury for your brethren, and also the influence that he had as the governor from Persia. So I think there would be quite a combination of factors. But there were also other moral issues, of which we are told in chapter 10 and 13, disobedience to the rules of the Torah, of the law, marriages to other nations, violations of Sabbath, and not supporting the Levites and the priests. So those were the challenges that Nehemiah had to resolve. And what we see is his great sense of ownership. It's his such an, both emotional and mental involvement that at some point when he is admonishing someone who did the wrong thing and married a person from another nation, it says that I was tearing out their hair. And now, I don't know how bad that was, but I still remember how a teacher would take me by my ear, hopefully not too many times, back in Poland when I was growing up. And yeah, holding somebody by their hair was pretty common in those days. I think that's really what Nehemiah does. I just recently watched a video of the Indian Prime Minister, Mr. Modi, I think is his name, who somehow was greeting a team of scientists, perhaps, whose project didn't go very well. And it was amazing to see how he hugged this main scientist and for about a minute
was patting him on the back with this great sense of a leader who was trying to really feel and sympathize the position. So I think Nehemiah was probably on both sides of this. He was supportive of those who were very energetic and very faithful to the Lord, because that's what he came to engender in them. But at the same time, he was critical and very angry. And he says that many times. I was very angry to hear this. He says, may the Lord... He was actually mentally asking for a punishment for those who were the evildoers. And he was praying for that. And he documented that for us. But what was the outcome? In the 20 and 5th day of the month Elul, in 52 days. Now, this is quite amazing. We talk about all this build-up. We talk about the 12 years that are going to be ahead of Nehemiah on his journey. And yet, everything here happens in 52 days. Now, this is the kind of project that everyone wants to be on. I understand from like working on projects, you know, when it's longer than 8 weeks, people lose interest. So now this whole new technique of working in an agile mode, where you work just on the thing that you see right in front of you, that is definitely confirmed to be the right thing to do, that kind of has people's attention. Because, you know, if you decide to do something today and 2 years later, the requirements might change, you know, the people are not very interested in it. But it looks like Nehemiah did the right thing. He divided it into these sections, was able to achieve it in a very short period of time. But why so quickly? Well, perhaps we'll have some thoughts about that. One thought is that some special holiday was coming up, and we will see that this month of Elul if we look at this calendar with the laser pointer again here, right here, and we go in this direction, we will see that the month of Tishri is coming up. So I think there was a certain deadline. It's like, you know, when we sometimes work in our workplace and say, we have to meet this deadline because you know what happens after that. It's going to be this big event. We have to work up toward it. Well, what was happening in the month of Tishri? Well, special month, and we want to just show this right here. There are three festivals in the month, the seventh month of the year, the month of Tishri, the Feast of Trumpets, or beginning of the Jewish New Year, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, with which we are very well familiar, and the Feast of Booths, or Sukkot, which reminds the nation of Israel that they dwelt in various difficult situations. They have to build their tents and have that experience of what it was to be in that situation. Well, we think that these three were celebrated, and we know from the records, were celebrated with great enthusiasm. Just at that time, they enclosed the walls, and if we have it right, if that real enclosure of oblong shape was really what they finished, they had a pretty nice, I don't want to say cozy, but a very well-defined, secure environment, where, as Jews today in Israel say, where the Jews can be Jews, where we can feel free and safe. And it just came to me that as we look at these walls here, we can feel kind of safe. We kind of see how the wall provides a certain sense of togetherness, of some closeness, of a certain sense of being, you know, together and being able to focus. And I think that's what they really, truly enjoyed. They read the law, and we find that the law was read in Hebrew, and there were some people who were trying to help others make sense of it. Well, that was because that Hebrew language wasn't well known by everyone, and so there were scribes who were translating to Aramaic and saying, this is what you have to do. And a great sadness overcame people. There was a prayer of confession of sin, that what they've done both through the departure from the law back in the day for which they were taken to Babylon, and even what they're doing right now is still in much need of improvement. So a covenant was made. In chapter 10, we read to obey the Torah and have some specific commitments, such as supplying the necessities for the Levites, such as not marrying people from other nations, you know, and so on and so forth, and observing the Sabbath. And so we read then that after this, there were more plans to fill this newly surrounded, newly strengthened city, but still underpopulated. There is a verse that the city is kind of large, and that's what the proponents of this kind of maximalist theory say. Well, maybe this is really
talking about these broader walls. And so that's to be still probably further studies. But we had, I think this is when the 12 years really begin. The 52 days really happened very quickly, but the 12 years was the time of management and populating, and there were lots cast who's going to dwell in Jerusalem, who's going to live in the villages. And at the end of the 12 years, Nehemiah returns to Susa, and he asks then the king for another leave, but I think it probably took about 3 years for Nehemiah to go there, stay there, reconfirm that he's still good with the king, and then come back. And what he found when he came back to Jerusalem was not that great. This was the test of the resolve. A room in the temple was rented to Tobiah, one of the three enemies. Nehemiah had to clear that out really quickly. The Levites were neglected. Many of them could not do the work around the temple. They had to go work in their fields. Nehemiah corrected that. The Sabbath violations, intermarriages occurred. So he issued the appropriate corrections. And this is really how we see Nehemiah in this chapter 13 summarizing this work. He continues to be very much of an owner and a dedicated servant of God, and executing these different corrections in an appropriate manner. But in his final words in chapter 13, verse 31, he says, "Remember me, oh my God, for good." And I think that we will remember Nehemiah for good as we study the details of this book today and tomorrow, as we consider the depths of the decisions he had to make, the challenges that he was up against, and the things that he had in his heart as well. In chapter 13, verse 14, he says, "Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and wipe not out of my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for the offices thereof." Or 13:22, "Remember me, O my God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of thy mercy." You see the humility in his heart, and even though he accomplished these great things, he still, just like the Apostle Paul says, that I would not be rejected while preaching to others. May my attitude of my heart be correct and good, and may my deeds be the demonstration of what I had in my heart. So we will continue our lessons, and we look forward to the conversation on Nehemiah. But if you want to remember just one thing that I took away, it would be that the Lord opens the door but doesn't push you to the door. And He gives you that opportunity, but He also tests your resolve and your strength. And that was the case with the nation of Israel returning. We see how the remnant only returned, and how it took people such as Zerubbabel, such as Ezra, and Nehemiah to lead the people and to give them the encouragement and tell them not to be. So there's definitely still lots of questions. This is just the starter. There's definitely some gaps that we didn't cover, maybe some inconsistencies. Looking forward to more understanding on that, much as you can take and as you need. Use this information throughout our convention as a faith-building and inspiration opportunity. And let us see God's character in all this, and let us see how we can build and develop ours. May the Lord bless us during our convention.